Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. The other evening at the regular meditation class at Yoga Mendocino in Ukiah, the theme for the evening was equanimity, and one of the people who was there was a Chinese speaker, someone who'd been a student of Master Hua for a long time, and the Pali word for equanimity, or that we translate as equanimity, is upeka. And he asked a question at the end of the, or during the latter part of the evening, and pointed out that in the Chinese, the Chinese characters for upeksha, the Sanskrit, was actually a combination of the character for kindness and the character for renunciation. And he was asking, so how does that how do you see that fitting together with equanimity? And he said he'd never heard upeksha translated as equanimity before. So it was interesting to consider, and I thought that has I've been reflecting on that, and that's been coming to mind since then. How do these qualities fit together? One of the attributes of this community, Abhayagiri, is that we come from the what's known as the Thai forest tradition. That's our parentage. And one of the characteristics, or one of the ways that this tradition is described, is that of the Dutanga tradition, which distinguishes this particular style of practice within the particularly within the Theravada world, but also in the northern Buddhist world. So in the language of the terminology they use at City of 10,000 Buddhas and the Chinese speaking world, they call the Dutangas the bitter practices. And Master Hua had a great aphorism, probably an ancient Chinese aphorism, which was bitter practice, sweet mind. And in a similar way, the Dutanga practices are held or understood in the Thai forest tradition as well, they're known as the austere practices, or practices, ascetic practices, and the parallel aphorism that you have in Thailand is they talk about this approach to practice, to Dhamma practice, as the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. This might seem like a very unappealing topic for a Saturday evening Dhamma talk. But there's a purpose to it, just as there's a purpose to this style of life, and this focus of practice is not just out of a sort of perversity or looking for trouble and difficulty, but it's a particular approach that has a very powerful and beneficial set of qualities that come with it. So the Buddha came from an ascetic tradition. Before he was enlightened under the Bodhi tree, he practiced severe austerities for about 6 years, from the time that he left the household life until he discovered the middle way and realized full enlightenment. And he was extremely hard on himself and practiced all kinds of painful and difficult forms of self-mortification, going without food and suffering a great deal of pain and hardship, to the point where he said he got so skinny he could, when he touched the skin of his stomach, he would feel his backbone, and that his ribs stood out like the rafters of a broken down house, and he was so emaciated, so weak that when he tried to. One day when he just was trying to urinate, he just fainted and fell over on the ground, just completely passed out. And it was through these kind of experiences he realized, I'm trying a bit too hard here. Maybe I'm being a little bit too tight about this. And then the insight into the middle way then came in some of the stories. It describes how he heard the sound of a musical instrument being played nearby, and he realized I'm cranked up too tight. I'm like the strings of a vina of a lute that are wound far too tight, so the sound is too sharp. Before, when I lived in the palace, then I was like a vina that is the strings are too slack, that everything is flat and clanging, and now I'm too tight. And then he had the insight, maybe there's a way to achieve a quality of harmony through finding the strings tuned to a perfect tension, an appropriate tension. And then through the insight into the middle way, then that was the source of his enlightenment, his understanding of how do you find that place of perfect balance. So he knew the way of great austerity, and he realized that just enduring pain and difficulty was not an end in itself. And as he himself expressed it, you know, I know the limit to which feeling goes. I know how much pain a human being can experience, and he said, I can do that. I've done that. I know that just by experiencing an enduring painful feeling, that's not liberating in and of itself. It's not just a matter of being able to tough it out and endure difficulty. That's not liberating or purifying in any way. So he understood that, and then after his enlightenment, he still kept up the life of a wandering. Meditator, a wandering ascetic, but he had a very different approach towards austerities or towards the kind of challenging side of meditation. One of the reasons why he went off on his own was because after he had this insight into the middle way, the fellow ascetics, the other five companions who were with him, were so disgusted that he actually started eating ordinary food. That he received some milk rice from Sujata, a woman in the village, and actually ate this milk rice pudding. They were so appalled and disgusted at such indulgence. Rice pudding? What kind of a monk are you? But they gave up and left him. After his enlightenment... Then his approach towards asceticism was of a whole different order. Rather than going along with the idea that the more austerity or the more pain you experience, the more purifying it is, he saw that was really as a common view, but it was really a wrong view. And then instead he realized that it was there was a whole different principle involved. And when he was asked about the basis for ascetic practices, or whether when he started teaching, whether he encouraged that for his disciples. He said that if you want to take on ascetic practices or any kind of austerity or extra limitation in your practice in terms of how you what the food that you eat or how you sleep and so forth, he said if you're doing it to impress the lay community, to impress the donors, then that's not appropriate. If you're doing it just because everybody else in the monastery does it, then that's not an appropriate reason. If you're doing it just because you want to impress your fellow monastics, then that's not an appropriate reason to do that. Or if it's just because you believe that you're burning off bad karma by experiencing painful feeling or difficulties, so that's not appropriate either. The only reason why you should practice any kind of austerity, any kind of extra limitation, is for the sake of developing simplicity. Learning how to live simply, learning how to be one of few needs. And so this is really the spirit that the Dutanga tradition is carried on in. So this is the kind of lineage we come from. So that within this, this forest tradition and the Dutanga tradition, it's a particularly simple life. Well, we aim to have a particularly simple life. So that the Buddha outlined clear limitations on what kind of ascetic practices he encouraged. So that he said there were, I won't go into all the fine detail, but there were 13 of them, and they included things like just eating one meal a day, just living on food that you're given when you go through the village on the alms round, just wearing robes made of discarded cloth, you know, cloth that's been thrown away, rag robes, and just living at the root of a tree, not using a hut, but just living under a tree root, or not lying down to sleep at night. These kind of ascetic practices he allowed, and that so that the tradition that we come from uses these kind of ways of or what are seen as allowable spiritual practices or austerities, not just to make life difficult or to make our things harder for ourselves, but to cultivate the quality of simplicity, to develop that spirit of renunciation. And how this relates to equanimity then is that we realize that the more that we are able to use this kind of training, or this is the spirit that we are using in our practice here at this monastery, and what people can learn here, is that the more that one cultivates this kind of readiness to live with the austere or the challenging, then the more able we are to deal with the variety of conditions. So here nowadays it's a Vyagiri. It's really quite plush, actually. Like Mike and Mimi here haven't visited for about 10 or 11 years. So it was very different. In those days, when they last came here, it was, you know, it was really rough. This looked much more like a garage than a shrine room than it does now. And we were living in pretty basic huts. And now Ajahn Pasna and mine both have cabins with indoor bathrooms with hot and cold running water and fans. So you could say, what's he talking about? A Dutanga tradition. This is these guys are living in the lap of luxury. But the spirit of the Dutanga tradition is that, yes, it's lovely to have these beautiful, quiet fans whirring away above our heads on this hot summer evening. It's very nice. I appreciate this. But if suddenly the power goes out and the fans stop and we all get hot and sweaty, then the development of the Dutanga practices, the austere practices, means that there's an adaptability in the heart, that we're not going to panic or freak out or just get upset and angry or irritated or depressed because things are not going our way. And that's the whole purpose of this style of practice, learning to, say, live on one meal a day, or learn to not lying down at night, or the other kinds of allowable austerity that the Buddha outlined for the monastic community. It's so that when things are less than comfortable, less than what we would prefer, less than convenient, we don't immediately just try and change the nature of the world, but we look more at changing our attitude, finding that extra capacity within the heart to be open to the way things are, to be adaptable and to recognize, oh, well, it's just hot. Like today, it was interesting, a few of the visitors who came up from the Bay Area or come from further away today, arriving here and this afternoon, think, wow, it's pretty steamy here. Well, we have been living here in Redwood Valley and Ukiah Valley for the last week. This is balmy and cool. Hey, it's only 97 today. This is like chilly. It's cooled right down. Oh, what a relief. It's only 97. Where it was hitting the 110 plus in the last few days. So this is a very different attitude and a very helpful way that I found to cultivate in our lives. And so for the monastic community, we have these Dutanga practices laid out by the Buddha, but they also represent not just something for the monastic community, but also a set of standards or qualities or encouragements for the lay community as well. The word Dutanga literally means something like a means of shaking off. So it's like the world is we can get stuck to things, stuck to our preferences, stuck to our likes and dislikes. And the Dutanga practices are what help to get us unstuck. It's like the sort of some kind of oil or a glue or kind of sticky paint or some gunk on your hands. It's when you get some detergent or some turpentine or something that gets the gunk off your fingers. It helps to get us unstuck. It's that which helps that stickiness of likes and dislikes, fears and desires, loves and hates that the mind gets so carried away by. And it helps us to develop a quality of simplicity of heart and an adaptability, so that when things are as we like and as we prefer, having nice, efficient, quiet fans, having vehicles that can take us to and fro, comfortable clothing to wear, pleasant food that's easy to digest, then we feel happy and grateful for that. But then if the fans go out and we get hot and sweaty and we're wearing clothing that's uncomfortable or difficult and the food is undigestible, and that we have guts ache and physical discomfort, then we still are able to not create a problem out of that. And also not just with physical difficulty, but one of the things about learning to deal with and open the heart to physical discomfort or physical challenges is that when we realize, oh yeah, it can just be hot and I can feel sweat running down the body and not make a problem out of it, then similarly I can feel emotional suffering, emotional difficulties. I can be with a person that brings up a lot of irritation, or I can experience a painful memory or a powerful longing and not make a problem out of it. there can be a presence of that which we do not like, that which is unlikable, a painful memory, a feeling of threat, a feeling grief and longing, or any kind of painful or negative emotion, and we realize, oh, this is how it is sometimes. Just like sometimes the thermometer goes over 110 and stays there. Sometimes it's like that, and so that quality of equanimity, that is, which is a great spaciousness of heart, a steadiness of heart, we can find that, we can tap into that. And so this is really what these kind of austere practices, the Dutanga tradition or the bitter practices, point to, as this wonderful aphorism, bitter practice, sweet mind. When we are training ourselves to stay with, say, painful feelings in the body or restless urges within us, and to just open the heart to that discomfort, that difficulty, that unloved, unlovable physical feeling or mental feeling, and when that's a genuine openness to that, there's a real acceptance, a kindness towards that unlovable feeling, that painful grief, that big regret, that unrequited love, that huge responsibility, whatever it might be, that their heart opens to that, there's a kindness, a radical acceptance of that, a spaciousness in the heart to that, then we find there's a peacefulness, a steadiness within us. So these simple practices and this style of life that we try to follow here, and the lineage that we've come from, it endeavors to embody that. It was very impressive over this last few weeks having Ajahn Sumedho staying here, who's he was the first Western monk to study with Ajahn Chah in Thailand. He was ordained as a monk in northeast Thailand in 1967, and joined Ajahn Chah later that year, shortly after his full ordination as a monk. And so he's been a monk for over 40 years now, and he was over here teaching a 10-day retreat at Spirit Rock Center, and then staying here for a couple of weeks. And shortly after he left, then Bhante Gunaratana from Bhavana Society, who's been ordained even longer. I think he became a novice when he was about 12, and then he has been a fully ordained monk when he was 20, and he's now 80. So he's about getting on for 70 years in robes. And these are world-famous, world-renowned Dharma teachers, and people who are high, not only world-famous, but highly revered and much-loved people. But one of the striking things about both of them staying here for this time was how extraordinarily humble they both are as human beings. These are big guys. they're really important, yeah, in a way, famous in the little world of Theravada Buddhism, maybe, but seriously famous in a small world of Theravada Buddhism. But day after day, moment after moment, what these beings exhibited was a simplicity and humility, over and over again. It was really clear. It's not just something that's put on, or they remember to do it occasionally, or they think, "Well, don't you know who I am?" And there's a sort of, I think, some sort of humble act or remembering to be simple or because they're supposed to. But what was really striking and of great power and really impressive and gladdening, inspiring, is seeing how the result of their years of meditation and their spiritual training is of an extraordinary simplicity and adaptability and a humility. So that is also an aspect that comes from the developing the meditation, and that quality of a fewness of needs, that it's not just a matter of getting by, you know, learning to be happy with whatever food you end up with each day or whatever clothing you happen to wear. It's not just in terms of the thing, a simplicity or an adaptability in terms of material needs, say, which is part of it. But it translates into an inner simplicity, an inner humility. So there's a readiness in the heart to not require a lot of requiring the world to be a particular way in order to make me happy, not requiring the people around me to be a particular way, or the weather, or the situation. You know, so that you could see for both Lumpho Sumedho and Bhante Gunaratna, there was this inner adaptability and readiness to accord with conditions. So if it was busy and there was a lot of people, they were okay and they were ready to be with that. If it was quiet and they were by themselves, they were happy to be with that. And that unneediness, that undemandingness within as an inner quality is something that is a powerful encouragement to the rest of us, is a very beautiful quality of human maturity. One of the other interesting things about the quality of renunciation, like in the Pali, the traditional Buddhist language, the usual word for renunciation is nekamma, but rather like upeka, there isn't really a good English translation for upeka. There isn't really a good English translation for nekamma, because so to us in English, the word renunciation, it implies a state of lack, or that we are being ever so strong, going without something that we would really like, or that we would really, you know, that we can think of as really being ours, but we're managing without it, and that's making us strong, and that's a good thing. But the spirit of nekamma is really this lack of neediness. It's like an inner independence, an inner simplicity. So it's in a way embodying the Dhamma itself, so that it's finding that place in our heart where nothing is lacking, and that we are content and complete. So that it's that even though from the outside it might look like we're going without, say, dinner in the evening, or we're going without fans in our kuti, because even though Ajahn Pasno and I have beautiful beautiful fans that we can turn on our kutis, all the other monks and novices, lay people here, don't. That readiness to be able to be content with his and to not feel like I would be happy if only I had a fan in my cabin. I would be happy if only I had something to eat, if I didn't have this discomfort in my stomach or my foot or my head. That quality of renunciation is a recognition of, in a way, a completeness, that there's nothing that we are burdened by, nothing that we're lacking. That we can say, well, there's a feeling of hunger, but that's a feeling, that feelings come and go and change. Or there's a feeling of having a headache, or there's a feeling of having an excessively long list of things to do. But yeah, that's a feeling, that's a perception, they come and go and change. And that the more that we are able to cultivate this quality of renunciation, or kind of inner simplicity, blessed simplicity, discovering that, finding that quality of inner wholeness, then from the outside it can look like renunciation, that we're going without, that we're enduring the difficult. But inside, there's no, you know, heavy thing being carried, or no big loss that's being endured with gritted teeth. But the inner experience is one of simplicity and wholeness. There's an embodiment of Dhamma. The heart is content with the way things are. Now that doesn't maybe the other thing to stress with that, being content with the way things are, doesn't necessarily mean that we take a completely passive approach to life. So it doesn't mean that we are just stupid. Yeah. Otherwise, we would never have put these beautiful new fans in, or refurbished the hall and made this alcove and put the shrine further back and made a bit more space in here. Or we wouldn't have built these posh kutis that Ajahn Pasno and I have. So we are ready to work with the way things are, and to if things are appropriate, or things are offered, or things are in accord with what's possible and what's workable, then certainly we can make life easier for ourselves. It's we don't, and this is part of the style of the Buddha, that if he was offered useful things or good things or even luxurious things, he would recognize that if it was offered with a pure heart and it wasn't sought after or obtained through deception hinting or in any kind of inappropriate way, then it was acceptable and good. So even in his own lifetime, he was sometimes criticized by other ascetics and yogis, saying, "How can you possibly accept his delicious food and his banquets when the royals come to the monastery and offer all this delicious food? What kind of an ascetic are you that you're eating all this kind of this fine fair, like sometimes that happens here on a weekend, like this morning. There was this substantial banquet that we were offered through the many, many people that came. But the part of the spirit is, well, if it's offered and if it's there and it's not sought after or obtained through undue pressure or through demandingness, then it's received with innocence. But if no food had showed up today and there was nothing to eat, and then Christine, the kitchen manager, said, "Sorry, the dana that was supposed to come today has not arrived. There is no food." Then we would have adapted to that. It's pretty unlikely. Very unlikely. But if the food doesn't show up, then the training is just to be content with that, open to that hungry feeling or that sense of, "Oh, I was expecting food to show up, but it didn't come. Aha." But then recognizing that essentially there's nothing missing, that there was an expectation that was there and it's arisen, because usually food will appear at that particular time, but today it didn't come. That's the way it is sometimes. So that when things are workable, when there's an opportunity, then we can work with the world, work with the material things that are offered, that come to us. So we've spent the last 10 or 12 years developing this place and building cabins and making trails and slowly converting this garage into a more and more beautiful and spacious shrine room. But if it all falls apart, if we've avoided the fires so far, but if the fires come through and torch the whole thing and take it to the ground, then so be it. That's the flow of things. Then one day it will certainly all come to an end, and the elements that make up this place will separate for sure. We're not looking forward to it, or not trying to make it happen sooner. But if it goes that way, then we're able to draw upon that adaptable and flexible quality of the heart, so that the use of this kind of approach to practice, this what you can think of as the duttangas or the ascetic practices, it's really to cultivate a quality of simplicity, a readiness to be open to the way things are. But then on that basis of openness and lack of neediness, which brings a robustness to the heart that it makes us much more able to deal with the ups and downs, with the times of plenty and the times of absence. Then when things come together and we can make life more easy or comfortable or pleasant for ourselves and our friends, then so be it. But if the things don't allow that, then we are not missing anything. The economy collapses and the monastery just stays in this particular state of development, that there's no more opportunity to or possibility to build any more cabins or fix anything up or give anything another coat of paint, then fine, we'll just carry on the way things are. But if things continue to allow the place to be developed and the community to grow, then that will happen. We can bring us give our heartful energy to that. And this culture is one that encourages a huge amount of dependency, that we are told over and over again through the media in different ways, we need all kinds of things to make us happy, that we can't possibly be content unless we have these particular possessions or these particular programs or these particular qualifications or systems of support. And we're all very familiar with this. This is all painfully clear to all of us. And so that this part of the usefulness of this kind of approach to practice and a deliberate cultivation of simplicity and a lack of dependency is to help us to deal with the pressure that comes from the culture, the world around us, that keeps telling us over and over that you are not complete, you've got to have this, you really need this, you can't possibly be content unless you have this new upgrade or this new vehicle or this new self-help program or this new bigger, faster, better, or smaller, faster, better nowadays is and that those signals are coming at us from all sides with great regularity, so that this kind of approach to spiritual training is so helpful. Because it's a gentle and steady and realistic counteraction to those influences. It's like a track that's leading in the opposite direction that says, well, is there something in me that doesn't really lack anything? Isn't there a dimension of my being that's actually full and complete and not requiring anything to make it whole or to make it satisfied? And then helping us to recognize, yes, that's always been here. And to give us confidence in that, to help us have faith in that, and to encourage that, to strengthen that. So this has already been a very long day, and we have had many, many wonderful and fine events happening already. So not to make more cause for patient endurance and suffering of more discomfort than necessary, I will conclude my offering there, and please take whatever is useful from what I've been saying, and whatever is not, please leave aside.